That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
Hello, and welcome to the Bill Press Pod Reporters Roundtable. I'm Ginger Gibson, Senior Washington Editor at NBC News, sitting in for Bill. Here in our nation's capital, it's about 8:30 in the morning on Friday, May 3rd. Lots to get to today. Sunday marks 6 months until Election Day. Trump's trial reveals more about the hush money payments and detours into the salacious. Trump's on Time, the magazine cover, protests rock college campuses across the country, and Biden weighs in. Mike Johnson is still the speaker for now, and Kristi Noem's dog. To make sense of it all, our three top journalists, Charisse Datte, senior White House correspondent at HuffPost.
Hey, good morning.
Nikki Schwab, senior U.S. political reporter for the Daily Mail. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, guys.
And Alex Rorty, politics reporter at Notice Reports.
Ginger, thanks for having me on.
Lots to talk about, lots to go over. Let's start with Trump's trial continuing for the third week this week in a Manhattan courtroom. Let's start with you, Nikki. What was the most interesting thing you saw come out of Trump's trial this week?
So I have to cop that I've been on Biden duty all week. So I'm probably not the best person to, to answer this question. But what I thought the most sort of interesting thing that came out of Trump world this week was that Time interview. And I think that would be we would be talking about it nonstop if it weren't for this trial and for him, getting gagged, every day or getting fined for these, for gag order violations and him sort of mouthing off every day after court. But, it's crazy to think that, there's something more explosive than what he plans to do in his second term.
Yeah, we'll get to some more of what was in that Time article. How about you, Alex? Anything jump out to you from that trial this week?
I there were a handful of things. I think, this week, it's like the writers decided they had to up the dramatic flair in the trial, and the names like Hulk Hogan and Charlie Sheen were mentioned. The defense was trying to cross-examine one of the prosecution's witnesses, Stormy Daniels' former lawyer, Keith Davidson. And, they were trying to paint him as an extortion artist. And, they said he's tried to get these payments, as he did from Trump, in the past from people like Hulk Hogan and Charlie Sheen. And, I think the view generally was that it was a somewhat effective line of questioning. It doesn't really get to the heart of the matter, of course, which is whether or not Trump and mislabeled these payments to Michael Cohen, as a legal defense as opposed to a hush money payment. I will say, though, I think the most significant thing, the thing people will remember the most from the trial this week, is Trump's own, not actually something that happened in the courthouse, but was related to that. Trump writing that he didn't actually fall asleep. He isn't actually continually falling asleep, as some news accounts would have you believe. He's just resting his beautiful blue eyes to try to take it all in. It's the sort of moment that truly only Donald Trump, I think, in our politics or in our political history would say something like that. It does point at, though, I think, maybe an increasing vulnerability for a guy who is running against Joe Biden, accusing him of being too old and not up, not fit for office right now. He can't seem to stay awake at his own trial. And I think Democrats are really trying to seize on this as an opportunity to say, which candidate, again, is the one who's not up for being president anymore? Clearly, Trump is at least a little sensitive to those accusations.
Let's go next to someone who was in the courtroom and maybe knows Trump better than any other reporter working the beat, and listen to what Maggie Haberman had to say about whether or not Trump is snoozing in the courtroom.
Sometimes he is sleeping. That is 100% true. I've seen it. People around him have confirmed to me that he has been sleeping at times that we have said he is.
Trish, what do you make of this? Is he sleeping? Is he not sleeping? Does it matter if he's sleeping? There are no cameras. There are no pictures. Can Democrats make hay of this?
Of him sleeping?
Yeah,
I suppose. But I mean, I think ultimately this trial will go to the fundamental thing about Donald Trump. He's exhausting. He's nuts, right? This is he was the incumbent president, and he lost by 7 million votes. And what Biden needs to do and what Trump wants to avoid doing is remind people of that, of why he lost. It's people he is exhausting. And this whole trial goes to exactly that point. Yeah, of course he was sleeping. I mean, everyone around him says that. Why is this a big deal? I mean, sure, he may go to prison on this, but it's boring. And so he fell asleep. It happens. More important, I think, what he did would be a career ender for any normal person, right? He paid off a porn star and then lied about how he did that in order to avoid it coming out before trial, before the election. And so think of, could this happen to any other Republican, any other Democrat? No, that would be it. End of career. But for him, this is, people in a month, guarantee. After this trial's over, it'll be, we all knew about this. It's part of his thing. It's baked in, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, we'll see if it's baked in or not.
It's interesting. I think that, you know, I live and breathe this trial every day. I'm coordinating coverage on it. And so I'm in it constantly, basically chained to my desk, reading the testimony as it happens in real time, as we have a staff basically there at the courthouse transcribing in real time. And I do think that there is something to be said, though, about how this paints him and how it depicts him. Yes, it's baked in, but to understand that these are the types of things Michael Cohen was doing, these are the types of people, you know, there's a double-edged sword that I think we're watching his defense try to balance very carefully, which is they want to just demolish the credibility of Michael Cohen, of all of the lawyers who were involved in this, all of these people around him, so that the jury doesn't believe him. But also we're saying to the jury and to the American public, Michael Cohen was the kind of person Trump kept around for a long time. And a guy who had this long history and all these problems is the kind of person Trump was relying on to do a lot of his business. And I think that there are still some political risks there. To your point, right, that we look at polls and people now think that his presidency was more successful than Joe Biden's. They think that it was a good presidency, and they don't remember some of the chaos. And so this does serve as a bit of a reminder for that. I guess the big question is, when it's over in May or June, does anyone remember in November? 6 months away doesn't seem like that long, but it is a long time in the minds of many voters. So it feels like there's a lot going on and can happen in between then. But Nikki, you mentioned this Time article that we saw come out, felt very peak Donald Trump, that he sat for two interviews with Time. What was the biggest surprise or takeaway from that you, after reading that interview?
Well, I think the Democrats are going to use is his what he talked about when it comes to abortion, like monitoring pregnancies. I mean, that sounds, you know, like dystopian, basically. And, you know, you already saw Joe Biden, he had this closed door fundraiser on Wednesday at the Mayflower Hotel, and he was reading that portion aloud to the crowd, being like, guys, like, look at this. I mean, Trump is detailing all these things that he wants to do. And, you know, we're not really talking about it, but like, this is, you know, a must read. But sort of getting ahead of what we're going to talk about on the podcast. But then at that same event, what Joe Biden did is had a gaffe and called Japan xenophobic. So the headlines that came out of that fundraiser were not about, you know, Joe Biden warning the country about what Trump had said in this Time magazine article, but in fact, you know, that he potentially, you know, kind of gaffed about a major ally that he's been courting for years.
Alex, what did you make of him again sort of saying or previewing another round of not believing the election results? To me, that was one of the things that really jumped out off the page to me in that interview. Are we looking at a repeat of 2020 on that front?
at one level, we shouldn't be surprised. Donald Trump has always said this. He has always said that elections that he didn't win, were fraudulent in some kind. Someone was actually pointing out to me online yesterday that even the elections he does win, he says were fraudulent. Still, somehow it included, illegal ballots cast for his opponent, all of which is false, of course. I think we should absolutely expect that nothing will change from 2020. I don't know why we would think that things have changed. The Republican Party has more or less dismissed the idea that January 6th was that in any way disqualifying for Donald Trump. He has gone on to win the GOP nomination easily, of course, in this year's primary. There's no reason for him to change his behavior. And I do think, it's funny. I think it's related to that point, but I feel like every three out of every four emails or tweets I see from Biden officials is basically trying to call attention to some, off-kilter thing or some absurd thing that Donald Trump has said, and trying to get people to focus on his actual policies. I think there were a handful of things in this Time interview. Nikki mentioned allowing red states to monitor pregnancies, his threats not to, accept the results of the 2020 election. In the same interview, he's talking about deporting 11 million people from the country. And I think they're part of the effort from the Biden administration, the Biden campaign, I should say. And I think they're a little frustrated about this, is just having to try to call attention to this, because these are really major policy planks and they seem to kind of come and go in the political media ecosystem, pretty quickly. But the Biden campaign clearly sees that there, could be some political downside to Trump if they could just get people to pay attention to it.
Suresh, do you think there's any political hay to be made by Biden, or is it all baked in, as you said earlier?
Well, it again, I think it reminds people and can be used to help remind people with paid advertising, et cetera, that this guy really doesn't believe in democracy. To me, that was the most striking thing of that entire interview, was the quote at the, I think it was at the end, about when the writer was saying, "Don't you see why you're talking about using the DOJ to go after enemies and cracking down on dissent and all these other all these authoritarian things? Don't you see why that offends people and why it worries people about a dictatorship?" And he said, quote, "I think a lot of people like it." And you know what? He's right. A lot of people are okay with authoritarianism, as many as 25-30% in the United States. And, this is not unique to the U.S. This, all liberal democracies have a component of a slice of people who'd be just okay with the strong man. And to me, that's something that Biden has hit upon, even before the 2020 election. He's saying, this guy thinks and talks like an autocrat. January 6th proved it. And now he's talking about it again. So, yeah, I think it's a problem for him if the president can persuade enough Americans that, hey, you know what? This goes to the heart of our country. And he wants to end that. And if you want to do that, do it with your eyes open. So, yeah, I think that I'm amazed they allowed him to sit for 2 hours or whatever it was in total with this guy who did a very tough interview. And again, a lot of things with Trump are baked in, but people voted against him for a reason. They were tired of it. And maybe this will help remind people of that.
Nikki, 6 months, you pointed to this Time article at first. Is this something that we're still talking about 6 months from now? Are these points still something we're talking about 6 months from now? How do the Democrats sort of keep this message going?
This is his plan for, term number two. So I think that would have to be something that's being discussed up until the election if the Democrats are smart. Because, as my colleagues have said, he said a lot of very sort of anti-democratic things in this interview. But yeah, the Democrats are going to have to figure out how to message that properly. And, when I'm out covering Trump, I'm at, these Trump rallies. I mean, those are not the voters those voters are going to vote for Trump, right? So it's those important swing voters and you know, the Pittsburgh and Philadelphia suburbs that have to be sort of swayed back into the Biden column. And I think, you know, especially sort of messaging on abortion could potentially help Democrats do that.
Alex, let's start to shift a moment to these protests we're seeing. Is Biden, those swing voters, are they looking at these protests, Trump this week trying to say, this is chaos, Biden is the one bringing domestic chaos, not I. Is that message resonate with those swing voters? Can Biden push back at it?
I think he tried yesterday. And I've seen some follow-up even the next day from his administration trying to show the ways in which he has pushed back against the protests. Look, I think if Americans feel that the situation in the country is chaotic, which they very well might if they turn on the evening news or if they are paying closer attention to the coverage of college campuses and the protests there, of course, that's not going to help the incumbent president. You know, I think the George Floyd protests in 2020, when Donald Trump was president, didn't help him. You know, the response to that, I think, was politically complicated. But I think there were a lot of voters and Democrats and Republicans will tell you this, who looked at that situation, looked at Donald Trump's response to it, and penalized him for it. You know, the question to me politically going forward, it's twofold. One is, of course, look, the election is in 6 months. Are people really going to be thinking about campus protests if this is the sort of thing that is going to go away in a few weeks? You know, are people going to be thinking about this in November? The second part of it is, even if you are thinking about it, even if you don't like what you see at Columbia or elsewhere, how much do you hold Joe Biden accountable for that? And that, to me, is a real key question. Again, you know, Biden pushed back yesterday in remarks from the White House, unscheduled remarks. You know, clearly his team felt like they needed to get him out there and make his position clear that people have a right to peaceful protest, but not to disruption. You know, and he included the protest in that latter category, right? I just don't know if you're able to make that connection between the protest and Biden directly. You know, the bigger concern is if people just feel, generally speaking, the country is off kilter and chaotic, then they could penalize Biden for that. But look, you know, there are going to be a lot of important stories between now and November. And I think, you know, whether or not what we're seeing on college campuses now, if that's going to be determinative to November, I'm pretty skeptical.
Let's listen for a moment to what Biden had to say on Thursday.
Violent protest is not protected. Peaceful protest is. It's against the law when violence occurs. Destroying property is not a peaceful protest. It's against the law. Vandalism, trespassing, breaking windows, shutting down campuses, forcing the cancellation of classes and graduations. None of this is a peaceful protest. Threatening people, intimidating people, instilling fear in people is not peaceful protest. It's against the law.
Charisse, when you listened to the president yesterday, is he delivering an effective message? Does this help calm some of the political woes, or is it inflaming the people on his left who are already not happy with how he's handling the war in Gaza?
Well, I think both of those are true. I'm not sure the second one matters as much. I mean, I was pulled yesterday. I was right there. It was a very effective statement. It was short. It was 3.5 minutes. And then he left without muddling it with answers that, you know, went off on different tangents, as he sometimes does. So I thought it was a good statement. By the way, he said something similar before, unscheduled, and in response to a question at the Earth Day event that I pulled like 2 weeks ago. And he kind of said the same thing. Nonetheless, if you go back and look at the sort of things people, the progressive left, was saying about Joe Biden in 2019, in early 2020, it's kind of the same thing. They hated Joe Biden. They wanted anybody else, particularly, especially Bernie Sanders. So, you know, in the end, those voters, if they vote, are going to have to decide, are we going to punish Joe Biden by bringing back a guy who may end democracy? And, you know, I guess that's the challenge for the Biden campaign. But in terms of the protests, one, I think an important point here is that this is not like 1968. Okay, back in 1968, the people protesting were because their friends, their relatives, they themselves were at risk of dying in Vietnam personally. And that was very visceral and very different from a country that's 5,000 miles away, killing 10, 15, 20, 30,000, whatever it is, people who they don't really know. And, you know, America is not going to get that concerned about it as they were if we still had a draft and people were being sent over there and dying. That's two very different things. You know, I'm not saying that speaks well about us, not necessarily caring about something that's going on in Gaza, but I think that's the fact.
Alex, you've written a bit about RFK Jr. and his sort of struggles as a campaign. I think the thing that part of this is that you have to, if you're unhappy, if you're on the left and you're unhappy with Biden, you have to have somewhere else to go. Do they have somewhere else to go?
Where they could go is home on election day and just not vote, right? And that's one possibility. Another possibility, and some people on the left, you know, have a natural affinity for Robert Kennedy. His campaign is getting on the ballot in a lot of key states, even just this week, making more progress on that. I think he got on the ballot in California. You know, whether or not 6 months from now, after a campaign and watching and reading what Kennedy and his campaign are putting out, they're still satisfied with him. That's another story. You know, I interviewed a Kennedy advisor this week, and we had reached out to them because I always find it fascinating to look at what the candidate and the campaign say they actually want to do when they're in office. What are your stated policies? Literally just your policy page on your website. What is it you want to do? And there are ideas on there that would appeal to people on the left, right? He's talking about backing 3% home mortgages at a time when it's hard to find a mortgage rate below 7% at the moment. You know, and that's the kind of policy and theory that people on the left would, you know, support and could really draw them to Kennedy's campaign. That is, except, you know, when I talked to a Kennedy advisor, a man by the name of Charles Eisenstein, and he said, look, I'm not entirely sure how this would work. You know, I don't know the details of how we would implement it. And I don't even know if it would work because we're talking about setting it up as a bond. I'm not sure investors would be interested in that at the time. So it was this kind of bizarre situation. And to me, really was a telling moment because it felt like, look, once you start to scrutinize this campaign, the details don't always hold up. The campaign doesn't always hold up to that scrutiny. And I wonder if for voters on the left, it's going to be a similar process over the next few months. You know, look, that said, it only takes so many defections, right, from people who voted for Biden in 20, who, you know, if they decide to vote for Kennedy in 24, for it to be a serious problem for the president. You know, Donald Trump does have a little bit of the same issue. He has similarly been attacking Kennedy because I think he and other Republicans are aware that he could draw from Trump as well.
Lots more to talk about, including what happened this week with Kristi Noem's dog, which we will get to after a short break on the Bill Press Pod Reporters Roundtable. I'm Ginger Gibson from NBC News, sitting in for Bill along with Nikki Schwab, Alex Rorty, and Shrish Date.
Today's podcast brought to you by the United Food and Commercial Workers Union. Yes, those good men and women, 1.3 million working men and women strong, members of the UFCW. Under President Mark Perrone, they service all of us in many, many different ways at our big retail stores like Nordstrom and Macy's, the people who take care of us at our great grocery chains like Safeway and Whole Foods, those on the front line in our meat and poultry processing plants, chemical plants, and cannabis plants. We thank the men and women of the UFCW for their great work taking care of all of us Americans, and we thank them for their support of the Bill Press Pod. Go to their website, check it out at ufcw.org. You'll be amazed at all the good causes they're involved in.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
We are back on the Bill Press Pod Reporter Roundtable. I'm Ginger Gibson from NBC News, sitting in for Bill, along with Sharish Date from HuffPost, Nikki Schwab from The Daily Mail, and Alex Rorty from Notice Reports. Let's move from the White House to the Hill, where the drama in the House of Representatives continues. Sharish, what is going on this week with Mike Johnson, and is he going to still be the speaker next week?
Yeah, this is a fascinating thing that's happening with Mike Johnson, right? Because what do swing voters supposedly want? What do Americans out in the real world supposedly want? They want a Congress that gets things done. They want to have them to stop bickering and do stuff that people can agree on. Well, Mike Johnson did that with a major piece of legislation, and his right wing lost its mind and wants to get rid of him. And he's not going anywhere because the Dems are going to say, we're done with this. He's staying. That's that. And it's interesting that the primary antagonist that he has right now, Marjorie Taylor Greene, could have brought up her motion to get rid of him weeks ago, didn't. Now it's going to be next week. And if you have the votes, you bring it up. If you don't have the votes, you stall. So that's what's going on. You know, this is really interesting because Americans, although they say they want a bipartisan harmony in Congress, they always vote for people who don't want that or promising to never compromise, always fight, etc. So we'll see. If the Republicans hold the House, I'm convinced Mike Johnson stays, which is a really interesting thing, given where things were headed just a few months ago.
Alex, let's listen for a moment to Ted Cruz weighing in on Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Marjorie Taylor Greene, who will run off on any crazy wild tangent. I think what she's doing is ridiculous. I think it is foolish, and I think it is really counterproductive that she's trying to throw the House into chaos, and she's risking handing the speakership over to the Democrats. I think this is hurting conservative principles, and it's hurting the Republican majority that is already very fragile in the House.
Is Ted Cruz right? Is all this fighting hurting the Republican Party?
It's on Capitol Hill, right? I mean, it's just a sort of rolling mess and has been for several months there. It's just funny when I hear Ted Cruz say that, it really is a Ted Cruz 2.0 situation now, because there are a lot of Republicans who would have accused Ted Cruz of playing the Marjorie Taylor Greene role 10 years ago on Capitol Hill. And they would be right. It should be pointed out that Ted Cruz is now running for re-election in Texas in what might be a competitive race and is trying to build out his sort of bipartisan bona fides, whether or not you want to believe him or see him as a kind of bipartisan figure in Congress. That's up to you. There are a lot of Republicans, even Republicans on Capitol Hill, who might roll their eyes about that. But look, I think if anything that's happened over the last few weeks, you know, Speaker Johnson's hold on the speakership, you know, is not firm just yet, but he does look stronger and stronger. And I saw lawmakers pointing this out on Capitol Hill this week, that every time Marjorie Taylor Greene talks about this, you know, it's just driving home the fact that she doesn't have the votes, at least not with Democrat support, you know, the way that they said that they are going to support him. If it does come to a vote, I think the one lingering question is, though, if you know, it does come to a vote and he does require a lot of Democratic votes, and we do see a handful of Republican defections, you know, does that start to weaken him going forward just because it looks like he's there with Democratic support? And maybe that eats in further to his Republican support, you know, down the line.
I am old enough, Alex, to have covered the time Ted Cruz shut down the government 10 years ago. So I agree. It seems a bit like Ted Cruz 2.0. Shifting topics, Nikki, we all spent an unexpected amount of time this week talking about Kristi Noem's dog. Can you tell us what happened?
So Kristi Noem has a book coming out, which, you know, as politicians do, if they want to, you know, get to the next level in politics, they put out a book. And so I think, you know, this was probably her sort of planning to try to be Trump's VP. And The Guardian got an early copy of this book and reported out this story about how Kristi Noem had a 14-month-old wired-haired pointer that she was trying to teach how to be a pheasant hunter. And whenever this dog failed as a pheasant hunter and also basically murdered a couple of her neighbor's chickens, she shot Cricket dead. And, you know, this is not something that it's playing well with neither Democrats or Republicans, because if you do recall, you know, Mitt Romney got into a lot of political trouble in 2012 for, you know, fastening his dog on top of his roof for a 12-hour car ride to Canada. And, in that same cycle, Obama got in some heat for admitting that he had eaten dog meat as a child. So actually, you know, purposely killing your dog is not playing well with voters, and seems to have tanked her chances to potentially become Trump's VP.
You know, I'm a girl from the South and rural America, and I suspect that rural Americans are much more accustomed to having people talking about killing animals, but it does seem like killing your dog is an odd thing to volunteer. Did she just ruin her VP prospects by this sort of voluntary admission?
Well, I'm not sure her prospects were that great to start with, but nonetheless, I mean, there's only one person in the Republican Party in America who could get away with saying, yeah, the dog was bad, so I shot it. That's Donald Trump. Right. And then all of a sudden, half of the Republican Party, oh, yeah, you know what? Dogs should be murdered for no good reason at all if you don't like them. And Kristi Noem is not Donald Trump and was not able to get away with it. And so that's where we are. I can't imagine why you would put that in your memoir to try to make yourself look good. But maybe I'm missing something. Maybe she thought that it made her look tough, that she could murder a dog with a gun. But yeah. So if there was ever any hope of her getting on the ticket, that's probably gone. But remember, Donald Trump doesn't like dogs either. Okay. I mean, Nikki, you were probably there too at the ceremony where they had the hero dog on the, in the Rose Garden.
Remember that?
Right. The one who went after, I forget which terrorist that they killed.
Yeah.
It was one of them, right? And the dog was there. It was one of the special forces, and Mike Pence was petting it, and the dog was just glaring at Trump. And Trump was like looking nervously down at the dog, because if it was trained to go after like dictators and stuff, then Trump was probably in trouble. So anyway, you know, there's no love.
A germaphobe, right? He's a germaphobe, so he thinks dogs carry germs.
Perhaps, but it's, you know, don't they have fewer germs than we do? I forget. Anyway. Right. So, yeah. Bye-bye, Governor Noem.
And bye-bye. Just to sort of piggyback on this story, this is after she had done all those sort of abattorial things with her, like, new teeth and, like, her new sneakers. So, like, she was already kind of in the doghouse for some of that kind of weird stuff. And then now you've got her, you know, shooting her dog. So.
She decided to put this in her book, right? This wasn't an off-the-cuff revelation that she made in some interview. This was deliberate. The only theory that makes any sense to me is she is trying to compete for vice president, and she thought this would come out, and she's in a way trying to get out ahead of it, and she's trying to put it out there. But, you know, to get out ahead of something, it can't be a story that people find really horrific, right? And Republicans and Democrats do. So whatever her aim was here, I think it definitely fell flat, to say the least.
Well, it was definitely one of the most unusual additions to This Week in Politics, but it has been great talking with you all today about this week. I am Ginger Gibson from NBC News, sitting in for Bill, along with Nikki Schwab, Alex Rorty, and Shrish Date. Now it's time for our reporters to share their favorite story of the week, something that caught their attention beyond the big headlines, or just something they wanted to share with all of you. Nikki, why don't you go first?
So I have been really enjoying covering RFK Jr.'s campaign, and I sadly was not able to actually make it up to New York for this this week, but he had this special announcement in New York, and so he announced that he was going to sign this no spoiler pledge, which I thought was really interesting. And basically he's saying that, you know, in mid-October, he would like President Biden and himself to commission a poll, and whomever does better against Donald Trump, one of them should drop out of the race. So, you know, don't think that's going to happen, but, you know, points for being, I guess, bold and innovative. And I just thought that was something that didn't get a lot of coverage this week that was pretty interesting, because I do think that these third party candidates are going to potentially could sway this election.
Maybe that's an RFK Jr. exit ramp. Alex, what was your story of the week?
So I'm going to show for my own news outlet Notice, given that we're new and could use all the attention that we could get. My colleagues, Evan McMorris Santoro and Jasmine Wright, wrote a story, title which is "Students Are Protesting, the Democratic Convention is in Chicago. Is this another 1968? And their conclusion was it actually is not. You know, they talked to a lot of experts about that year and the different circumstances. Therese earlier in this very podcast, I think, described some of the differences between people protesting a war in which they or their friends could theoretically fight and die in versus the conflict in Gaza right now. You know, that is, I think we're always keen to make historical comparisons like that. It's a good instinct, but they're usually not so neat. And I think my colleagues, Jasmine and Evan, did a nice job walking through all the reasons why this year is different than 1968.
Yeah, very different. How about you, Shirish? What was your story this week?
Well, I honestly don't know if it was actually ever written up as a full story, but I couldn't help but notice, I believe it was yesterday, that the former president's asked again about testifying, said, no, I can't testify because there's a gag order. And, you know, this is like the one place he is allowed to mouth off about all the witnesses and stuff is on the witness stand in the trial. That's the only place he's allowed to do that. And yet he's totally lied about that and claimed, no, I can't because the judge isn't letting me talk. When just, I think it was as late as like last week, he said, yeah, I'm going to testify. All I do is tell the truth. So, you know, if someone hasn't written that yet, they should, because that is just art.
Let me get someone on that right now as we wait for Trump to come into the courthouse and queue up our NBCNews.com live blog, which I have been manning every day. But we will get on that. My story of the week is also Trump trial related and is also from NBC, but I couldn't resist this little thing that isn't getting much notice. If you want to know what life is like inside the courtroom as a reporter or as an editor at their desk, you can follow my Twitter. But as a reporter, Quirky Simizo has a great piece on NBCNews.com about the must-have accessory for every reporter at the Donald Trump trial, and that is a pair of binoculars. Reporters have been bringing binoculars into the courtroom so that they can see Donald Trump and whether or not he's asleep. It's a big courtroom. It's difficult to see. If many of them are in the overflow room, they are bringing the binoculars to be able to see the screen where they're watching the video feed come in from the main courtroom. But they have been increasingly in number as this trial has gone on. Not the first time a trial has included binoculars in the press, but we're seeing more and more of them. And Quirky just has a great write-up giving you a little taste from our reporters and some others about what it's like in that courtroom and why they are bringing those binoculars and what exactly it is they're seeing on the other end. So I suggest giving that one a read. That's a wrap for this edition of the Bill Press Pod Reporters Roundtable. Our thanks to you for listening, and to Charisse Date, White House senior White House correspondent at HuffPost, Nikki Schwab, senior U.S. political reporter for the Daily Mail, and Alex Rorty, politics reporter at Notice Reports. Next Tuesday, Bill talks with Roundtable regular Hunter Walker about his new book on how the progressive movement has shaped today's Democratic Party. That's next Tuesday on the Bill Press Pod. Until then, have a great weekend.